This week, we'll look back on some memorable interviews from 2013 with MSNBC's Chris Hayes, Jeffrey Hilgert, author of Hazard or Hardship, Crafting Global Norms on the Right to Refuse Unsafe Work, and highlights from an AFGE rally in Pittsburgh during the union's fight against sequestration. We start off now with Chris Hayes, host of MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes. Chris, welcome to the program.
It's great to be on.
Chris, last week we saw two major events shake our nation, the Boston Marathon bombings and an explosion at a Texas fertilizer plant. In Boston, we saw tremendous work, life-saving work, being done by public employees, from police officers to healthcare workers. What does this say to you about America's public workers, especially at a time when, at least at the federal level, they're faced with furloughs and sequesters?
You know, we've been wrestling with this all week about why it's been the case that there's been the kind of difference in attention paid to the two. I mean, look, there is something undeniably more terrifying about the notion of malevolent actors intentionally setting out to kill and wound as many people as they can. And that has a kind of grip on our imagination, I think, somewhat understandably, and particularly in the wake of 9/11. At the same time, I think the massive disparity in attention that's been paid between Boston and West Texas indicates that we as a society and as a media culture are very susceptible to looking at relatively rare threats and spending disproportionate time on them and ignoring much more mundane but much more common threats, like, for instance, deaths in the workplace. We know there's about 4,500 a year. There's been about 3,300 total fatalities in the last 10 years or the last 13 years, if you include 9/11, going back to the beginning of the century. You know, there's about 3,300 total deaths from terrorism. There's about 4,500 workplace deaths a year. And so I think it's very important that we, while we devote attentions and resources to the horror of Boston and follow that story carefully, that we don't lose sight of what happened in West Texas. And not just West Texas, because West Texas is illustrative of some broader issues about how safe our workplaces are and how well-regulated the American economy is.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. Of course, in this West Texas fertilizer plant, we saw 14 people die with devastation around the surrounding area. When you look at these workplace concerns, what's the biggest thing that stands out to you in this situation?
Well, you know, the biggest thing to me actually ends up being, well, there's two aspects. One is that, you know, OSHA hadn't inspected the plant in 26 years. And the OSHA budget is such that, you know, its staffing levels, which have remained constant despite the massive growth in the labor force, I think it's got the staff and budget to inspect every applicable workplace once every 129 years or something like that. You know, most OSHA violations or investigations are precipitated by actual complaints as opposed to routine investigation. And, of course, complaints are much more likely to come in unionized workplaces than non-unionized workplaces because workers have more security and power and are less worried about recriminations. And so what you see is a kind of combination of the under-resourcing of OSHA with the decline of labor unionization means it's very likely that we have more holes in our system. We should also be clear that over time, the good news is that workplace deaths are declining. They are still way, way too high, but over time, the trend at least is in the right direction. So that's sort of the good news. In terms of West Texas, what's striking to me is, A, the Dallas Morning News has been doing amazing reporting on the kind of regulatory record of this plant, and it seems like it was a pretty its regulatory record isn't shockingly terrible in that it wasn't egregiously reckless, but it does seem like it has had a number of regulatory citations, including just things like moving two 12,000-gallon tanks of anhydrous ammonia and not informing state authorities for another 7 years and things like that. So there seems to be a real regulatory story that we need to uncover here in the wake of the accident.
What do you think the lesson is that should come out of this tragic situation in Texas?
I guess what I would say is we literally don't know what happened there at all. And so I think it's a little bit early to be drawing lessons just because we just genuinely don't even know what caused the explosion so far. There is no information so far about which even of the two substances, ammonium nitrate or anhydrous ammonia, precipitated the explosion. I think the what it illustrates is the fact that, you know, OSHA continues to be recklessly underfunded, and Congress continues to put riders in it that make it very difficult for it to do its job. The Chemical Safety Board has an annual budget of $10 million, and it's tasked with investigating the aftermath of these kinds of industrial accidents. And finally, I think, you know, broadly, I think about the fact that we're having an explosion of natural gas production in this country, an explosion of fracking. Natural gas is obviously a flammable and volatile material that is now popping up in places all around the country and in areas that were formerly residential, right? And part of what's so awful about West Texas is the fact that you have this fertilizer plant that's adjacent to a nursing home and an apartment complex and right in there mixed in with the community. And obviously when it blew up, it took out this huge area of the town. You know, as we move towards a much more fracking-intensive future, what we are seeing is lots of very toxic and intense chemicals and heavy industrial activity mixing in amongst residential areas, and that is going to increase risk. And it makes me think about whether we are on top of the regulatory regime enough to make sure that that risk is identified and mitigated.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Chris Hayes, the host of MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes. Chris, you made a point earlier about the staffing levels at OSHA, which really speaks to a larger problem that we see in the federal government, and that really is the understaffing and underfunding of federal agencies. We see a situation here like in Texas where we know, like you said, the staffing levels at OSHA just sort of remained constant over the years. And we see a tragic situation happen. Do you think that it's time as a nation that we stand up and say that these agencies need to be staffed properly in order for them to run effectively?
Yeah, I remember talking to someone who was a lobbyist for big industry. He was talking about different ways that you would kill legislation, and one of the you know, one of the things that he talked about was the first bite of the apple is you try to kill the bill that creates some kind of new regulatory oversight. And then he said the second thing you try to do is if the bill's going to pass, then you try to get some language inserted in the bill or amendments put in that kind of carve out loopholes that protect you. But then after you've done that and the bill is law and there's actually an agency, your third bite of the apple and the one that you get year after year after year is just to make sure the agency doesn't have the resources to actually do what it needs to do. And, you know, we've seen this approach time and time again. And it really makes a difference. I mean, one of the things we're seeing in the early reports out of West Texas, it's not necessarily the case that there was not the statutory authority to regulate the fertilizer plant. In fact, there's at least, as far as I can tell, like seven different agencies between federal and state that had jurisdiction to regulate it. It was the fact that the last EPA inspection was in 2006, right? It was a question of whether the actual doing of the regulation, which is actually done by trained civil servants with expertise and institutional knowledge and institutional memory and resources and organizational capacity, whether the actual doing of the regulating was actually getting done. And there's a story there about the fact that agencies, particularly regulatory agencies, have to fight tooth and nail, particularly with a Republican Congress, to get the resources they need to do their jobs.
Let's go back to Boston for a minute, Chris, and we saw there obviously just a horrific situation, but in that we saw a lot of human good going on by the first responders, the people who were there to take care of the victims, the police officers, the healthcare workers. Talk about what that means in the larger sense.
Well, look, I mean, I think, times of emergency or crisis tend to illuminate certain things about the structure of society. Sometimes those things are good and sometimes they're bad. But they unquestionably illuminate just how much, in the midst of genuine crisis and fear, like we saw in the aftermath of Boston, how much we are reliant on the public goods and public safety and public workers, who essentially form the backbone of the security, you know, that we generally, and I think understandably, take for granted. And, you know, we saw it also with the volunteer firefighters, you know, in West Texas, who were just doing an incredibly noble civic duty. And I'm reminded of it every time I come across a firefighter fatality of, you know, that job is, you know, it's 99% of the time we those of us who don't have those lines of work can go about our day with some basic background security that if, you know, if a fire starts, someone's going to be there to put it out, that if a crime is committed or there's someone dangerous on the loose, there's going to be someone to track him or her down. And these moments when you have these intense and gripping and often harrowing public emergencies are reminders of how much the basic mundane stability we take for granted is built on a foundation that is laid by a lot of public workers.
And Chris, as we close out here today, as you know, of course, the economy is still recovering, still reviving itself. What must be done to finish the job, so to speak, and get the economy on the fast track?
Well, we need a political commitment to full employment. That to me is the biggest that's the biggest issue. And that's not something that is currently present. You know, we were just looking at a photo today in my office. The Joint Economic Committee had a hearing on long-term unemployment, and there was one member of Congress who showed up. If we were politically committed to full employment the way that we are politically committed to, say, Homeland Security, we would, I think, you know, have something much more like full employment. our fiscal policy is nowhere near aggressive enough. Our monetary policy is decent, but could be much more creative. There's a lot of things that we could do to put people back to work if we actually marshal the political will, and right now that political will is just absent.
And Chris, real quick, two things on that. One, what's holding back that commitment? And two, what kinds of jobs should we be focused on?
Well, the commitment, I mean, the turning point in that commitment was, of course, the Republicans taking back the House in 2010, and it's been a long, I would say there's a lot of Democrats who share responsibility, but the impetus from the turn from sort of expansive fiscal policy and aggressive attempts to bring down the unemployment rate to a focus on austerity, that coincided with the political backlash that was channeled by the Tea Party and the Republican Party into victories in the House that gave them control over a House of Congress that they have used as leverage to impose austerity on the country. And, you know, the president has in different ways fought against, attempted to minimize, sometimes cooperated with that austerity vision. He's given rhetoric, I think, that's been overly generous about the need for austerity. He's wanted to strike a grand bargain, but the engine that's driving the train of austerity is the Republican House Caucus and the 2010 election. That's the political obstacle right now. There's also a class obstacle, which is that, you know, the policy elite of this country, the political leadership, the elites in finance and in government and in business are incredibly removed from the grinding misery of long-term unemployment, from the grinding misery of stagnating wages, from the desperate circumstances that the jobless recovery and has imposed on millions of Americans, and so they don't care about it because they don't see it every day. So that to me is the obstacle. The kind of jobs we want are good middle class jobs. I mean, one of the depressing things about this recovery is that we've seen acceleration of inequality. We've seen a staggering percentage of the new income and wealth created go to the top 1%, and we've seen the jobs that were destroyed in the financial crisis and the aftermath were largely high paying and middle wage jobs, and the jobs that have been created are low wage jobs. And there's a connection between having a huge amount of surplus labor supply, that is, workers who are long-term unemployed, who are kind of sitting on the sidelines, and the depression of wages. Because, of course, businesses, you know, there's a supply and demand problem here. And so if we had tighter labor markets, I think we would see wages go up, and we'd see more high-wage job creation than we're seeing right now.
Chris Hayes, host of MSNBC's All In with Chris Hayes. Chris, we certainly appreciate your time today. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks a lot. I had a blast.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our look back on memorable interviews from 2013 with Jeffrey Hilgert, author of Hazard or Hardship, Crafting Global Norms on the Right to Refuse Unsafe Work.